Hi, hello, and welcome to Beyond Reproach.
I'm Stephanie.
I'm Tux. And we be drinking and we be swearing.
Sure are.
This is the show where we talk about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. Today, we are drinking some fancy-ass Bee's Knees cocktails.
It is the Bee's Knees, guys. Mm-hmm. It's so good.
Let's cheers.
Cheers. Into my laptop that went. It went like on my screen and like down to my leg. Did not go as planned.
Cheers fail.
Hashtag cheers fail.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
You know when you cheers and the drink goes directly into your laptop? That's exactly what just happened. Mm-hmm. Hashtag first, cheers fail.
Cheers fail. Anyways, these are some pretty fucking tasty cocktails. Basically, the reason we're drinking a Bee's Knees is that they are a Prohibition era cocktail, and Stephanie's scandal today will be Prohibition era. Bee's Knees is basically gin, lemon juice, and honey syrup, sort of just like honey and water mixed together. And the reason it has honey and lemon in it is to sort of mask the flavor of shitty gin, because during Prohibition,
like bathtub gin,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, bathtub gin. It was gin that it's basically grain alcohol with shit added to it to make it not taste horrible, but it definitely
not literal
tastes horrible.
Shit.
You never know.
True.
With these bootleggers,
yeah,
there was a huge push in during Prohibition to sort of come up with cocktails that were like sweeter or really heavily flavored to kind of mask the flavor of this really poor quality alcohol that people were drinking. So the cocktail is called the Bee's Knees because obviously most of you probably already know that the Bee's Knees means something is really cool, really hip.
Really like, tubular.
It's the best, basically. Like
totally
if something's
gnarly.
The Bee's Knees, it's the best. But it turns out when I was doing my research, this really has nothing to do with the cocktail because it's much earlier. But randomly, it turns out that the phrase Bee's Knees, when it originally was coined, didn't mean something it was the best. It meant that it was very small. Think of the size of a bee's knee. It's so weird.
I love it. I love it so much because I had no clue.
Yeah, I mean.
But it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Language is a funny thing, though. It's weird.
It
like, how did that turn into
That's a big jump.
What it means now?
Hmm. I don't know, but I love it.
It's because we are the Bee's Knees. You should cross-stitch that.
Oh my God, I should. I recently started cross-stitching and it is so much fun. I've been on Pinterest looking at all these different patterns and I have this idea of making Beyond Reproach, like having a store.
Ooh.
And having cross-stitch patterns featuring things that we say on the podcast a lot. Like,
yes.
God, there's so many things that we say. Like, we be drinking, we be swearing.
We do say that.
Because we be one.
We be drinking and swearing.
Yeah. Or just like the logo or...
F that S.
Oh, F that S. Classic, iconic phrase. I was also thinking of doing different patterns of like politicians that I love. Like I'm starting, well, I created the pattern for a one for Shirley Chisholm.
Oh.
It's going to take me a million years.
Yeah, that seems so real complicated.
It's, yeah, but it's going to be so good. I don't know if I would want to sell it. I would need to keep this for myself, but.
Do you have a thimble? Do you need a thimble for cross stitch? Is it like the kind of thing where you poke yourself?
Well, you use an embroidery needle and it's not very short. It's dulled. It's
okay.
A dulled edge.
Okay.
People do use thimbles. I have bought a intro kit. So it had a little tiny little pattern and it came with the embroidery hoop and the fabric and some different color embroidery floss. And a thimble. And I'm just like, this isn't sharp. I don't really need this. I'm not that delicate.
Apparently.
I've seen so many really fun, sassy statements set against like really floral backgrounds, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm currently working on this piece that has this side panel that's really flowery. It's so pretty. But then I'm writing, fuck the police.
Yes.
It's so fun, and it's part of my self-care routine because it's just really fun to stab things over and over again and create artwork.
I love that. Yeah. I have an embroidery hoop that Russell got me for, must have been Christmas, maybe? I can't remember what it was for, but I know it was a gift. It's Jerry Blank from Strangers with Candy, and it's all floral and adorable, and then it's got Jerry Blank, and it just says, yes, you can't.
God, I love her.
I love that show.
Strangers with Candy is so funny.
Do you know what? She has a new show. Amy Sedaris has a new show.
Well, is it like a cooking
show?
She has a cookbook
that you have. I have, one's like a crafting book. And
Oh my God, I need to get that.
So the show is like this weird sort of like demented Martha Stewart universe where it's like cooking and crafting and gardening and that kind of thing. But then at the same time, there's like characters. She plays multiple characters in the show, and there's like, she has a neighbor that's like crazy, but it's her. It doesn't really make like,
I love
it's hard to compare to any.
Wait, what network is it on?
True TV.
Oh,
it's on
True
TV. Yeah. I think it's called At Home with Amy Sedaris.
Okay.
It's basically like,
I've seen that in print. I didn't know what it was.
It's really cute.
Very cool.
It's totally demented. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
But
it's great.
Amy Sedaris. That's kind of her bread and butter.
Totally.
Yeah. She's doing her.
And oddly enough, this has nothing to do with anything. The cheese ball recipe in her cookbook is so fucking good.
Yeah.
You know, reading through those recipes, I thought it was just like the recipes were there just for like a vehicle for comedy. But the recipe for the cheese ball is super
good. Didn't you make it for a party that we had?
Yeah. And everyone fucking loved
it. Yeah. It's so funny that it came out of her cookbook.
Yeah.
Her cookbook with like air quotes.
Oh my God.
What?
There is a video of an old Martha Stewart show where Amy Sedaris was on Martha Stewart as a guest.
Oh my God.
And they had dueling cheese ball recipes where like Martha had her cheese ball recipe going, and at the same time Martha's making hers on the other side of the counter, Amy Sedaris is making her recipe.
That's amazing.
And she is so mean to Martha Stewart,
but in the
best way.
Yeah.
It's so entertaining to watch. Amy's putting like A1 sauce or something in her cheese ball. Like,
relatable.
Yeah. And Martha's like, oh, my recipe has chutney in it and blah, blah, blah.
Of course
it
does.
Amy's like, nobody wants to eat that. It's amazing. It's so fun to watch.
She's so great.
We could talk about Amy Sedaris all day and cross-stitching and cocktails.
Yeah.
But instead, we're going to talk about politics.
Politics. The bee's knees is prohibition era, like my scandal. I'm returning to Warren Harding.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I'm like, if you can return to different people, I should do the same.
And surprise, surprise, guys, I am returning to someone later in this episode, too.
Yeah.
But Warren Harding is he's like a treasure trove of
this is just the second of many in an installment.
Third.
Oh, God, yeah, that's right. Laddie Boy.
Yeah.
Damn.
I feel like we could do an entire season just on
it would
on
be YG. Hard to fit everything in in one season, actually, because there's so much. So President Warren G. Harding famously said, I have no trouble with my enemies. I can take care of my enemies all right, but my damn friends, my goddamn friends, they're the ones keeping me walking the floors nights. And he wasn't joking at all. My tale this episode is about the Teapot Dome scandal.
Yay!
Yes, that time when a young nation first learned that the oil industry could wield substantial and corruptive power and influence at the highest levels of government.
Oh, we were just babies back then.
Babies, yes. This was 20th century America's first great federal corruption scandal. And we've grown a lot since then, right?
Oh, scandals have gotten so much richer.
Rex Tillerson. Bless me. Oh, God, bless me. Allergies. I should have. It's a dog.
Yes.
It's the dogs.
Let me go get you a Zyrtec.
Thank you. So the Teapot Dome scandal centers on an oil reserve north of Casper, Wyoming. This particular oil reserve was located near an oddly shaped teapot-shaped rock, which is now, the spout has broken off, but that's how the rock got its name.
I actually didn't know that. I never knew why it was called that.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sort of looked like a teapot. It's kind of how astrology symbols look.
Yeah.
You're just like, okay, I guess
if I squint
and turn my head and I'm half dumb, maybe. Like, I can see it. At the turn of the century, oil had yet to become the primary fuel for all of U.S. transportation. In 1909, during the Taft administration, naval ships were still operating primarily on coal, which was both heavy and inefficient. Navy administrators decided it was time to convert the entire U.S. fleet to the more efficient petroleum. Ships would have no more need for these coaling stations, And once fueled, the petroleum-powered ships would have a far greater range. As more naval ships were converted from coal, Navy officials grew more and more concerned about the long-term availability of oil. What would happen if they were to run out? The Navy would be paralyzed, they thought. As a result, Navy administrators asked Congress to set aside federally owned lands in places where known oil deposits most likely existed. These naval petroleum reserves would never be drilled unless a national emergency made it necessary. So the Pickett Act of 1910 authorized the president to withdraw large areas of oil-bearing lands in California and Wyoming as sources of fuel for the Navy. One of the three petroleum reserves set aside was Teapot Dome. A dome is exactly what it sounds like. It's a geological formation that traps oil underground between layers of rocks, with the top layer looking like a dome, like bending up towards the sky. Oilmen throughout the West coveted the opportunity to drill within these federally owned reserves. And when Republican Warren G. Harding was elected president in 1920, these men got their chance. So I mentioned in episode 2, when I was glossing over Harding's administrative scandals to get to the erotica, I mentioned that his biggest flaw was his chronic need to be liked. He was a politician with heightened self-awareness of his intellectual limitations. He felt, rightly so, woefully underqualified for the position that he now found himself in. He was nervous about it, so he surrounded himself with old friends from his hometown who themselves were unqualified for the job that they now held.
Oh, great.
And many of them were corrupt.
Imagine. P.S. Sorry to interrupt. I just had a really good idea for a cross stitch. That quote from your first Harding thing about that his dad said, like, it's a good thing you weren't born a lady.
You wasn't born a gal.
Yeah.
Because you'd be in the family way all the time.
Yes.
Yes.
You could do like a baby rattle or something, yeah. And like a picture of Harding.
Ooh, note to self.
Yeah. Circle back to this episode, yes, to remind yourself.
So Harding's campaign slogan for the 1920 election was a return to normalcy. It's so funny. This slogan became kind of scandalous because normalcy wasn't a word that was used commonly. It was in the dictionary, but it wasn't commonly used in like regular speech.
Huh.
So newspapers, they replace it with normality.
Okay.
Even though that was his campaign slogan.
Yeah, you can't change somebody's slogan.
So I actually have a quote that's so funny. When I read it, I'm just like, oh, I love you. I love you so much. Harding swiftly defended his usage of the term, saying, quote, "I've noticed that the word normalcy caused considerable news editors to change it to normality. I've looked for normality in my dictionary, and I do not find it there. Normalcy, however, I did find, and it is a good word." And I'm like, oh, girl, let it go.
He has the best words.
Yes. I'm like, when I read that, I'm just like, oh, girl.
Yeah. Oh, that's...
Oh, sweetie.
That's amazing. But also, yeah. I would love a return to normalcy. That sounds great right about now.
So, once in office, his primary goal was to reorganize government to deliver on this promise of a return to normalcy by rejecting the activism and the idealism of his wartime predecessors and reigning in the government in the wake of an enlarged bureaucracy created by World War I. Harding appointed the straight-edged Herbert Hoover as his Secretary of Commerce. Hoover was the son of devout Quakers, so it should not come as a surprise that he was only invited to Harding's poker cabinet once.
Oh, he was once and never again.
Yeah, he was probably just like, I don't drink during prohibition.
It's prohibition.
This is illegal, and we're in the White House. What a stick in the mud. So, but he served some strong tea to Harding postmortem. In his memoir, he wrote that Harding, quote, "was not a man of experience or the intellectual quality that the position needed." He went on to say that Harding could not, quote, "control the terrible corruption by his playmates."
Well, he's not wrong.
Although Harding promised to appoint the most qualified people to his administration, he surrounded himself mostly with business cronies and relatives.
That sounds strangely familiar.
Right. Harding's circle of influence was known collectively as the Ohio Gang. I'm just going to pause there.
So that's why we're doing this scandal today.
Not completely. So these people, they would become a gang of politicians and industry leaders who rolled in his orbit for about 40 plus years. The ringleader was his attorney general and his former chief strategist, Harry Dougherty.
That name sounds familiar.
Right? Who was impeached for self-dealing and corruption. Harding's brother-in-law, the superintendent of federal prisons, faced similar accusations. His director of the Veterans Bureau was later convicted of defrauding the government and sent to prison. His personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, Charles Kramer, was accused of corruption. He subsequently hung himself. His campaign manager resigned from the U.S. Shipping Board after giving away surplus government-owned ships to his friends. He just gave government ships to his friends. Gave them for free. Here you go.
What are you going
to
do with a ship?
Yeah. It's like now I have USS Chicago, like some battleship.
I mean, that could be fun. Turn it into a yacht or whatever, right. But geez.
So these are just a few scandals that I'd like to explore at some point in the future. But none of these hold a candle to what his interior secretary and poker buddy, Albert Fall, was getting up to. Albert Fall was the one who orchestrated the Teapot Dome scandal and became the first presidential cabinet member to go to prison for his actions while in office.
Wow.
Yeah. Albert Bacon Fall, delicious.
Bacon?
Bacon is his middle name.
Huh, okay, cool.
Jealous.
Great. Delicious.
was born November 26, 1861 in Kentucky. He attended schools in Nashville, but was primarily self-educated. Fall struggled with allergies all his life, and he moved out west as a young man to seek a better climate. He tried Oklahoma, then Texas, but eventually settled in the New Mexico Territory, where he practiced law and tended to his cattle ranch. Before entering politics, Fall made a name for himself with his successful defense of Pat Garrett, the lawman who shot to death Billy the Kid.
Really?
Yeah, he defended him and he won. He looked the part of like a Western lawyer, like he looks how you would think he would look. He always wore a broad-brimmed hat, a bushy mustache, and had a cigar like permanently clenched in his teeth. His charming drawl and commanding manner made him many friends in business and politics. He was the product of the frontier ethos. So he made his money as a lawyer representing timber, mining, and oil companies out west. He saw regulations as a needless impediment to jobs and development. He hated bureaucrats so much he decided to become one.
So many correlations, but
right? And this is just the beginning. Fall's popularity earned him the first Senate seat in 1912 after New Mexico became a state. In 1914, he became friends with Senator Harding and became part of the Ohio Gang. In 1921, now President Harding appointed the New Mexico senator, a known opponent of federal conservation programs, the new Secretary of the Interior. What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yes. I love The Simpsons. Oh, so good. So Fall immediately, this is crazy, he immediately tried to pry control of the Forest Service from the Department of Agriculture.
What the fuck?
Yeah. He had designs on the natural resources of the Alaska Territory. Surprise, surprise. But he was thankfully no match for the powerful Agriculture Secretary Henry Wallace. Wallace was essentially like, nah, this is public land. This land is not your land. However, Fall was successful in convincing President Harding to allow the transfer of the Navy's petroleum reserves from the Navy to his department, arguing that the Department of the Interior was, quote unquote, better able to oversee protection of these areas where oil was not to be produced, but kept in case of emergency. The transfer was granted through an executive order that Fall wrote. On May 31st, 1921, Harding signed the executive order with the agreement of the Secretary of the Navy, transferring all the naval reserves from the Department of the Navy to the Department of the Interior. Harding largely ignored like the minutiae of running a government. So when Fall brought him this executive order, it's kind of speculated that he didn't really read it fully and he just signed it.
This sounds like it sounds like a metaphor.
Who could know what this really sounds like? Moving on.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It literally sounds like it's a metaphor for the current administration, and it's not. You're not telling the truth. You're just like telling a story to try and make it sound like it's...
I know. I wish that my eyes were darting side to side right now, and I'm just like, oh God, he's on to me. But this is a real story.
This really happened.
This really happened, yeah.
Hashtag real news.
Yeah, real news. So on April 7th, 1922, once the public oil reserves were under his control, Fall arranged leases with two prominent oilmen, buddies of his, without the opening of the process for competitive bidding. These oilmen were major players in the booming American oil fields of the early 1900s, Harry Sinclair and Edward Doheny. The oil reserves at Teapot Dome were released to Harry Sinclair's Mammoth Oil Company. Several weeks later, Fall also leased the other two reserves in California to Edward Doheny of the Pan American Petroleum and Transport Company. So the issue wasn't really the leasing of these public lands. Like, this was completely legal. There was a mining law from 1872 that allowed companies to extract minerals from public lands in the West and pay a very low fee for the privilege, and soon to own the land outright with the minerals and the profits that came from it. And this is the law that created oil tycoons, basically. The Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 divided the legal status of oil, natural gas, coal, and phosphates from the so-called hard rock minerals like gold, silver, copper, and lead, and established a new leasing system that continues to this day. The law does four things. It, one, enables entrance onto public lands to explore for minerals with the permission of the government. It enables, two, drilling and extraction of minerals with the authority of the government. Three, it enables the government to manage the exploitation of the leasable minerals. And four, it enables the government to receive compensation from the lessee for the privilege of extracting minerals on these lands. So it's like they pay a royalty.
Okay.
For the privilege to drill up these public lands. So the Bureau of Land Management, a division of the Department of the Interior, they are the ones who evaluate areas for potential development and award leases based on whoever pays the highest bonus during a competitive bidding period. Since Congress passed this law, again, this law goes back to 1920, it remains the primary statute guiding the extraction of oil and gas on public lands today. Federal regulators have struggled to keep pace with companies that seek to cut costs by evading royalty payments. Sometimes they just don't pay. And they take minerals and they just like, evading royalty payments, seeking preferential treatment from regulators, and sidestepping environmental requirements. These things commonly happen. And it's like, oh, who can police these things?
What can you do?
And now the bidding it's done online and it's completely anonymous.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Although the Teapot Dome and California leases were done in secret, newspapers quickly broke the news. Back in Wyoming, independent oilman Leslie Miller became suspicious when he saw trucks with a Sinclair company logo hauling drilling equipment into the Teapot Dome Reserve. He asked the Democratic Senator John Kendrick to look into the matter. Kendrick, sensing wrongdoing, turned the question over to a special Senate investigating committee. And in response, Harding wrote a letter to the Senate saying that he approved of the lease policy. And this directly ties him now to the developing scandal. Like, he could have just said nothing, but he's just like, no, I approve of this lease. So President Harding, he seems so unconcerned about the allegations against Fall. So much so that he even considered him for a post on the Supreme Court when this was happening. Again, moving on. While outraging many, including conservationists, competing oil companies, Navy officials, the leases did appear to be legal on their surface. Nonetheless, executives of several oil companies complained to Congress, and in April of 1922, Senator Robert Follett, he arranged for a Senate committee to really look into these contracts to make sure that they were really like above board. Meanwhile, President Harding took a summer trip out west to escape the bad press that was now happening. He stopped in Wyoming, enjoying Yellowstone, and continued on to Alaska and eventually to San Francisco. While there, the president died suddenly.
Oh.
Yeah. Many historians believe Harding basically escaped impeachment for his role in the Teapot Dome by having the quote-unquote good fortune of dying as,
I mean, I'm sure he didn't do it on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. No, but they're saying that he escaped impeachment. Like, had he lived, he would have been impeached. Yeah. I mean, such a conclusion is hard to proof at this point, because you know, you can't prove like a negative. So when Fall first took the job as Interior Secretary, his personal financial situation was quite precarious. Although he owned a ranch in New Mexico, a small ranch, he owned a lot of debts on it, as well as taxes going back to 1912. After the oil leases were signed, he abruptly paid off all of his obligations. He also bought additional parcels of land for his ranch, costing more than $120,000. His sudden reversal of fortune, attained while drawing a government salary of $12,000, soon arose suspicion.
Mm.
Senate investigators, including Thomas Walsh of Montana, took a hard look at his finances. In 1923, less than 2 years after taking office, Fall stepped down as Interior Secretary to enjoy time on his newly purchased ranch in New Mexico, as well as take part in lucrative oil deals in Mexico and the Soviet Union with Sinclair and Doheny.
Oh my God.
Which is not suspicious at all. It's crazy. So the Teapot Dome scandal continued through the presidency of Harding's successor, Calvin Coolidge, and ultimately led to the establishment of a committee on public lands and surveys to conduct hearings into circumstances surrounding government oil leases. Soon, the investigation would reveal that Fall received $100,000 in an interest-free personal loan, air quotes, from oilman Doheny to purchase land for his enormous, his now enormous, New Mexico ranch. As Doheny admitted in a statement to the Senate, he arranged for his son Ned to deliver the cash, arranged in five $20,000 stacks in a black parcel bag, directly to Fall.
What the fuck?
Yeah, money in a black bag, you guys. Literally, here's $100,000 in a black bag. In similarly suspicious dealings, investigations would show that Sinclair, so this is the other oilman, Sinclair delivered a large herd of livestock to Falls Ranch, and he had his company transfer some $300,000 in Liberty bonds and cash to Falls' son-in-law. While these were enormous sums in the 1920s, the amounts paled in comparison to the hundreds of millions of dollars that the oil men would profit from these leases in Wyoming and California. In his testimony to the Senate, Fall claimed that he had chosen to keep these lease agreements secret to protect the location of valuable national resources. And to prevent oilmen from secretly drilling the federal sites via adjacent production operations, which is something that actually does happen. It's called drainage.
Uh-huh.
If you've ever watched There Will Be Blood, at the end, he does this really crazy, God, he gets so crazy by the end, but he's like, I drink your milkshake. He's like talking about how if you have a really, really long straw, you can drink someone else's milkshake. Yeah. So if you have all the property surrounding a particular plot of oil field, you can just drink whatever is underneath.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need the whole area, basically. So yeah, he said that he was doing this to protect these federal sites from this drainage that would happen. In total, Fall received approximately $404,000, nearly $5 million in today's money. After the Supreme Court ruled in 1927 that these leases had clearly been illegally obtained, they were canceled, and the control of the reserves reverted back to the Navy.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. The result was a finding of fraud and corruption, which led to a number of civil lawsuits and criminal charges against Harry Sinclair and others. In the end, however, both Sinclair and Doheny were exonerated of the main charge of giving bribes to Fall, even though it's documented. As a newspaper reporter observed, when the two wealthy oilmen basically got off, he said that, you quote, you can't convict $1 million.
Jesus.
So Sinclair was sentenced to a 9-month prison term, not for bribery, but for contempt of court. This motherfucker had jury members of the bribery case followed.
Fuck.
Yeah. Followed. All of them followed. So like the judge got word of that, and then he went to jail for contempt, because he was having them privately shadowed. But yeah, so he was sentenced to 9 months in jail. He served 6 and he got extremely preferential treatment. He was able to actually leave the jail and work.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and it's like, this dude is not in jail. Like, he's just sleeping here, basically. As for Doheny, he was inexplicably acquitted of all of the charges, despite the evidence against him, despite that his son just gave him money in a bag. He approached the director, Cecil B. DeMille. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
Oh,
of course I know who Cecil B. DeMille is.
Oh, Cecil. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I said Cecil. Thank you. Cecil B. DeMille. So you know that he was like the first like Hollywood filmmaker. He put Hollywood on the map.
Have you ever seen Hollywood Boulevard?
But do you know his first movie? His first Hollywood movie?
No.
It's called The Squaw Man. Mm. Yeah, it's right. In the UK, they called it The White Man. It featured an interracial love story, and it was a silent Western film, drama.
I can't say that I'm surprised.
Yeah.
We've talked about how, as much as I love old films, there's a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, duh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he approached the director about making a movie, presenting his side of the story.
And, oh, fuck off.
Yeah. No, DeMille, he liked the idea, but he didn't make the movie at all.
Good.
Yeah.
That side of the story doesn't need to be fucking told.
However, Doheny, he did end up being the model for Daniel Day-Lewis's greedy, bloodthirsty character in There Will Be Blood.
But he's not painted in a positive light in that movie. Which I'm sure if he had gotten DeMille to make that movie, it would have been
his name had been sullied in the press.
Exactly. These are two different movies.
Completely different movies.
I actually didn't realize, I've seen There Will Be Blood, but I didn't realize it was based on a real person.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems absurd because he comes off as like a cartoon villain in that movie. Like, it doesn't seem like he's real.
It's based loosely on him.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know if Doheny like killed someone with like a pool cue.
I mean, it sounds like he might have from what you said today.
So Fall was not so lucky. Following the lengthy Senate investigations, he was tried for accepting bribes. Despite pleading the fifth, he was convicted. Fall was the first cabinet member ever to be convicted of a felony committed while in office. He was found guilty of bribery. He was fined $100,000. He was sentenced to a year in prison. And he told the parole board that, quote, "My version of the matter is that simply I was not guilty." And I don't know. I kind of agree with him. I think bribery takes two parties.
Yeah.
So if the people who pay you bribes aren't guilty, how are you guilty of taking a bribe?
That's legit.
Yeah. I mean, what he did was fucked up. What all of them did was fucked up.
Of course.
But like,
but you can't,
why should he be the fall guy?
Exactly. Yeah. You can't say that one side of the bribery. Yeah.
It's like prostitution.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the people who are selling it go. But the people who are buying it, it's like, okay, in a way. Yeah, so he, again, was found guilty, fined $100,000, and sentenced to a year in prison. The fine against Fall eventually was waived because by the time he was fined, he had lost all of his ill-gotten wealth at that time. And Doheny, his old buddy, old pal, foreclosed on his ranch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So Fall ended up serving 9 months of his 1 year sentence in jail before being released due to his failing health. He died in 1944 at the age of 83 after a long battle with illness. And yeah, so the Teapot Dome scandal was essentially a tale of an unqualified, inept president surrounded by greedy, morally compromised underlings. The Ohio Gang, they kind of took power in Washington following the turbulence of World War I, and Americans who thought that they were returning to normal life instead found that they were following a saga of thievery and deception. Although Fall did something scandalous at the time, what he did now, I think, is business as usual. He blazed a new trail for federal policy, a trail that led bare the toxic relationship between energy development and political power.
Yeah.
Fall's downfall, in my opinion, is that he took this money and used it for personal enrichment instead of using it to fund his campaign, which would be completely legal by today's standards, unfortunately. So until Watergate, Teapot Dome was the most infamous scandal involving a presidential administration. Yeah.
Huh.
Curiously, Teapot Dome inspired a young boy who would eventually become president.
Huh.
There's a quote, "Mother, I would like to become a lawyer, an honest lawyer who can't be bought by crooks," end quote.
Who is that?
Name the president. I'm going to give you five chances because it's...
Can't be. Is crooks a clue?
Well, I'm not going to say. "Mother, I'd like to become a lawyer, an honest lawyer who can't be bought by crooks."
I mean, I don't know.
I'll give Carter. You two guesses. Oh, no, it's not Carter. But yeah, that's a good guess, actually. Yeah. That's a good guess.
Not that he became a lawyer, but...
Yeah, it's a really good guess, actually.
I want to say Nixon just because
it is crooks. Nixon.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Crooks was a clue.
It was a clue. But can you imagine?
Nixon was my first guess, but I was like, no, it can't be Nixon.
Can't be Nixon, because duh.
That's so funny.
It was Nixon. So I just have one like side note sort of thing. So an obscure law from 1924 ties directly to the Teapot Dome scandal. It gives the Ways and Means Committee the right to demand the tax returns of every American. This is how they discovered Albert Fall was Brokey McPoverty. This law says that the chairperson must be provided on demand with any tax returns that he or she requests. He or she can then decide whether or not to share the information with the entire committee in regular session or not. So
that, I mean, that
it's a law that's been in effect since 1924. So I don't know what we're waiting for, but yeah, I will leave it there.
We just got there. We just got control of the Ways and Means Committee. So
yeah, and here we go.
Maxine.
Say
great. Well, on that note, my cocktail is empty.
Mine is about to be empty once I slurp it down.
That was great. That was really, I mean, juicy.
Real juicy, right?
Oh my God.
Real relatable. It's like today.
I cannot believe. Like, I mean, I said
the Supreme Court thing. I'm like, really, bitch? Really?
Did he like beer a lot? I'm surprised it's not his picture behind.
I know, right? I mean, the parallels are so strong.
Yeah.
So strong with this one.
All right. Cocktail time.
Cocktails.
Hey, and we're back with fresh cocktails.
Yeah, we are.
The bee's knees.
Yes, I feel like I can let my hair down now. Ooh. Woo!
Ta-da!
Woo!
Spilled a little again. But...
It's all right. I'm feeling real good. I have no responsibilities. I can let my gut out. I can drink cocktails.
Ooh. Put on
my
stretchy pants.
Already there, but thank you.
So, as I already sort of said earlier... This is the revisiting past scandals themed episode. And today I'm going to go back to last episode and talk about Grover Cleveland again. Grover the good, if you will. Grover the garbage juice, if you should.
Grover. Grover. Perhaps. Grover Cleveland.
Oh, man. That's his new name now.
Grover Cleveland. That is his new name.
Okay, so in our last episode, I talked about Groper Cleveland, a.k.a. Grover the Good, who was in reality a total piece of shit.
Yeah, the good is in air quotes with eyes rolling.
Before he ran for president, he was busy being a womanizing scumbag and alleged rapist in Buffalo, New York. So if you haven't listened to episode 8 yet, get on it. Get on your shit.
What's your problem?
You may find this shocking. But he was still human garbage juice even after he moved into the White House.
What?
Today, I'll be talking about how our fat old walrus of a president was still a bachelor when he was sworn in, but he quickly moved on from stealing babies to robbing the cradle once in office. And the American public was super happy about it.
What? Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. To start, I need to quickly bring it back to our last episode to just remind you of a couple things. Remember how old Groper named his secret? I'm mentally changing my entire outline.
I like that my drunken mispronunciation has become a thing. You're like, yes.
His name is Groper. Yes.
Correct.
So remember how old Groper named his secret son after his best friend and law partner, Oscar Folsom?
Terrible.
And remember how when the story broke in the papers about his secret son several years later, Groper tried to say that he might not actually be the dad because Maria had also been sleeping with old Mr. Folsom. And also, don't forget that his dear old Oscar couldn't confirm or deny any of this because he was too busy being super dead.
Yeah, super dead, you guys. Like real dead.
Yeah.
Under the ground.
Like deceased.
Yeah, deceased.
So basically, Oscar Folsom died in a gruesome carriage accident in 1875, leaving behind his wife Emma, their 11-year-old daughter Frances, and no last will and testament. Seems weird for a lawyer, but what do I know?
Yeah. I could see if you're young. Like,
you're still a lawyer, you should have a will. And you live in the 1800s. You could die at any
time. True. Facts. Never mind. He should have done better.
Yeah. So the court appointed his old buddy and law partner, Groper Cleveland, as administrator of Folsom's estate.
No!
Rather than his wife, who was still alive, Emma. This was the 1800s. A woman couldn't possibly manage her own estate. She
couldn't possibly.
Yeah. And they put him in charge of looking after poor, frail old Emma.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go on. I'm sorry. I just felt the rage.
Like, seriously, so fucked up.
Rising, and I'm like, wait, but she's not a real person in the 1800s.
No, so. She was a woman, so not legally.
Not a full person. Human. Yeah.
So the court also put Groper in charge of looking after Emma and overseeing little Frances's upbringing and education. Emma thought that Groper.
Thank you. I'm like, who?
Might make it official and marry her, too. But at least for the moment, he was too busy with his political rising star. I mean, she's a woman. She's not anything without a husband. And he's overseeing her finances and estate, so.
Oh, wow.
She's like, yeah, my husband's dead. I have to find a husband right away. Yeah. But so he was really busy focusing on his political career and didn't pop the question. Since he was still a bachelor 10 years later, when he took office as president in 1885, he took his sister with him to manage the household at the White House in place of a wife. He was almost 50 years old at the time.
I didn't know about this. Yes. Yeah. He was one of the bachelor presidents. Yes. There's only a few of them. Mm-hmm.
But the public was obsessed with the fact that he was a bachelor.
Yeah. And he was like non-gay bachelor, which is...
Yeah. A womanizing bachelor. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was almost 50 years old at the time and the public would not let his bachelorhood go. So there was a ton of speculation in the press.
He's fucking 50. Let him live his life.
50 in 1885
is like a million years old.
Yeah.
He's like 85.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, in today's terms, he was 87, you guys. Exactly.
So there's all this speculation in the press about his marriage prospects. Like, people would not shut up about the fact that he was not married. And popular opinion put the widowed Mrs. Folsom at the top of the list for a potential first...
How old was she?
I actually don't know. She had an 11-year-old daughter when Folsom died, which was 10 years before Cleveland took office. So she's probably in her 40s, I'm guessing.
That's an old woman.
Yeah.
Like, to have a 10-year-old daughter and you're in your 40s. Like,
the daughter was 11 when her husband died. So
daughter was 11 when the husband died. Okay.
But the Cleveland took office 10 years later. So.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Got it. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Thank you.
We've been drinking a lot of gin today.
Hashtag gin.
So when Emma Folsom left for Europe with her daughter in 1885, the press was certain that she was traveling to buy her wedding trousseau. When they returned to New York 9 months later, their ship was swarmed with photographers wanting to catch a glimpse at the future first Mrs. Grover the Good. And they almost got the story right, too. The very next day, the White House issued an official statement to announce...
I feel like I know what's coming, and I want to go in a cave underground and rock in a fetal position, but go on.
So the very next day, the White House issued an official statement to announce that the president was, in fact, engaged. Not to Mrs. Folsom, though, but rather to her 21-year-old daughter, Frances.
Oh, God. So, you guys, I've been looking away from the microphone and holding my chest because I suspected this was going to happen, but I'm like, no, it's going to be okay, Stephanie. No, it's not going to be okay, guys.
Mm-hmm. So, Cleveland had known little Frances Folsom since birth.
Ew!
And had even given her her very first baby carriage as a gift when she was only a few days old. She grew up calling him Uncle Cleve, and he called her Frankie or Frank. Frankie's dad had died 7 years before she enrolled at Wells College in 1882, so when Uncle Cleve asked Emma Folsom permission to send her some letters and gifts while she was away at school, Emma probably assumed he was trying to act like a doting father figure. In reality, he was crushing hard on the 18-year-old Frankie, and the affections behind his regular letters and gifts and weekly deliveries of fresh-cut roses were anything but paternal. A few months after she graduated, Uncle Cleve sent her another letter asking, "Would you put your life in my hands?"
What? Wait.
Be my bitch? Yeah.
Would you put your... Let the record reflect that I am holding my chest, arms folded, angrily.
Angrily.
Angrily. If this was a play, it'd be like, Stephanie angrily folds her arms.
So Emma Folsom was floored by Cleveland's proposal to her daughter. Even though 10
Gross!
Yeah, so fucking fucked up.
I'm sorry.
Even though 10 years had passed since her husband died and no question yet had been popped to her, she was still like, why not me? Like,
yeah, because I'm an adult.
Yes. I'm much closer to your age. She's probably still younger than him.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously she is.
The fact of the matter, though, is that Uncle Cleve
I know. I'm just thinking of him being like, sit on my lap.
So the fact of the matter is that Uncle Cleve hadn't kept his intentions a secret from everyone either. His sister used to hassle him about being single when he was governor of New York, and his response was, "I'm waiting for my wife to grow up."
Oh my God. Oh my God. He's a pedophile.
He literally said, "I'm waiting for my wife to grow up," to his sister.
Ew! 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 Tim, edit out three of those ears.
I think... Infinity ears is the appropriate
ew,
response.
I'm sorry. I'm not sorry, but this is fucking gross.
Yes.
That he actually verbalized these things to another,
when
like, adult.
When she was younger, too. When she was, like, before she was even 18.
Oh, yuck. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Yuck.
So, in the love letters he used to write to Frances before their marriage, he would often refer to himself as her, quote, old man. Frankie and her Uncle Cleve were married.
Is this story over?
Frankie and her Uncle Cleve were married in the Blue Room of the White House only 5 days after she and her mother returned from Europe. The Clevelands spent a 6-day honeymoon in Deer Park, Maryland, and reporters were constantly
ooh,
spying on
Deer
them.
Park. Yes, Deer Park. Ooh.
Yes.
Ooh.
The reporters would sneak into restaurants and wait near the kitchen doors to find out what the Clevelands were eating. And they would even, they built like a platform so that they could spy into their hotel room with binoculars so that they could report on what they were doing during their honeymoon.
Wow.
Frances was the first woman to be married in the White House. And at 28 years younger than her husband, she was and still is the nation's youngest ever first lady.
How old was she?
21. 21 years old. And he was,
I can't believe that
he
was illegal.
49. Yeah.
What kind of. Even, like, the youngest president is 45 years old. They're still a fucking monster marrying a 21-year-old.
It's absurd.
A monster.
Yeah.
Like, get someone roughly close to your own age. Ew.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go on.
Don't be sorry. That is the appropriate response.
I am so angry. Like, all I feel... Like, my skin is hot. I'm about to, like, unzip my jacket.
That might be the gin.
Yeah, I mean, no, but I feel like it's the anger as well.
Yes,
it's,
yeah. It's a combination
in
of factors.
Combination. It's synergy.
So a handful of papers tried to make a scandal out of their age difference to smear the president, but most of the population didn't give a single shit. She was young and beautiful.
Well, I'm sure.
And that's all the American public wanted to focus on. They didn't care that this young woman was married to a fat, gray, old walrus of a man who was
fit into a regular bathtub, you guys. Can't fit into a regular fucking bathtub. Not to, you know, body shame people, but I'm going to body shame him.
Yeah,
he's garbage.
If anyone does. He was more than twice her age and had once acted as a father figure to her.
If he's giving her her first gifts, like, what are you doing?
But, like, legally he was never given legal guardianship over her, but he was appointed to sort of oversee her education.
And that seems like a conflict of interest. But again, women weren't people back then.
Exactly, exactly.
Fuck it. Ugh.
So they didn't care about all this stuff. They just thought that it was adorable that Uncle Cleve called her Frankie, and they started calling her that too. They also thought that it was just great that she had to have sex with her Uncle Cleve and bear his children. She was the first lady to ever give birth to a child while her husband was president, and people loved watching their children grow up in the White House.
This, I could see that.
Yeah. This actually did a huge service to Groper to help him polish his image from absentee deadbeat dad to devoted family man. Frankie was widely considered to be one of the most charismatic and glamorous ladies of her time, and she became an instant celebrity. Newspapers would report on her every move, and photos of her inspired women around the country to imitate her hairstyles and fashions. She received thousands of fan letters and was often mobbed by fans and admirers. Businessmen quickly started capitalizing on the marketing potential of this bright young face and started using her image without her permission to endorse pretty much anything they could think of. Candy, perfume, cosmetics, patent medicines, cleaning products, even ashtrays and underwear.
Oh, wow. This is before copyright infringement and like brands in general, I guess. So they would just take her picture and like put it on
whatever they felt like.
Some perfume, like Frankie by Dior.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or Frank. A lot of people called her Frank too.
Well, that wouldn't
work. She preferred Frank over Frankie. Yeah.
I love her.
It's funny because she actually did some good stuff, but I'll get into that. She was kind of great.
She's just so young. I can't imagine a 21-year-old in the White House.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. So the whole thing with all of these businessmen putting her image and her likeness on all these products became such a problem that Uncle Cleve got one of his friends in Congress to... I'm going to keep calling him that. So he got one of his friends in Congress to introduce a bill to prohibit using any real woman's image for commercial purposes without her express written permission.
Thank you.
The bill,
okay,
however,
Uncle Cleve.
The bill never even came up for a vote, though, and it actually made the problem even worse because after that, these businesses thought that they had like a free pass to just do whatever.
Why did it come up for?
Because
they're just like whatever.
He was an unpopular president.
He was a very unpopular president. Yeah, very, very, very.
So while a lot of first ladies back then were already using their visibility to influence political policy, Frankie stayed out of politics despite her popularity. This was largely thanks to her Uncle Cleve, who insisted that, quote,
gross,
a woman should not bother her head about political parties or public questions.
Shouldn't bother their head.
He even wrote to her once.
Oh, no.
Before they were married, to say, quote, ladies always make trouble. That is, when there are a lot of them together all bent on the same thing. If I can get one of them all alone, then I am all right. Clutch your pearls.
Let the record reflect that all the oxygen has been sucked out of this room. Predator?
Old Groper. He really disliked her popularity, which he said was because he wanted her to have more privacy and feared for her safety.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Looking at the story with a wider lens, though, it seems much more likely that he actually resented her popularity and influence because he was relatively
so unpopular
and
people
ineffective.
People fucking hated him.
Yeah, he was not liked. Whether it was to keep the peace with him or because she was young and easily influenced, we'll never really know. But either way, she did agree with him that a woman's role was in the home. And she even shared his opposition to women's suffrage. That didn't mean, however, that she didn't use her influence at all. She did her best to find small ways to do some good while appearing apolitical, at least on the surface. She began to host events at the White House on Saturday mornings, held especially for those working class women who were unable to visit during the weekdays. Some of the Washington establishment were a bit shocked to see, quote, common shop girls, government clerks, maids, and other service industry workers lined up in the East Room.
Oh, wow, the pores.
But the events were a regular feature of her tenure in the White House.
Okay.
She also did her best to encourage women to pursue higher education and professional employment, and to foster women's careers, especially in the male-dominated field of professional music. She even sponsored a violinist who went on to become the first ever American, male or female, to win the prestigious Mendelssohn Award. After seeing some girls eating out of a garbage can,
oh my God,
she also helped establish a charity for women of color with the strangest name I've ever heard.
Okay.
The Washington Home for Friendless Colored Girls.
I mean, it's fucked up. However, it was accurate.
It was the 1880s.
Yeah.
It was a charity.
It was a charity.
It's a good thing.
She was collecting money to help these colored women.
Yeah. The charity was founded by a black woman.
Oh, okay.
But she helped this black woman establish
it. Oh, that's amazing. Oh, so good.
Yeah.
So good. Okay. The name needs work.
Yeah, exactly.
But still really good work.
Yeah. Basically, to be honest, I don't really understand what she saw in Uncle Cleve. She was beautiful, popular. She was young.
She saw a way out of wherever, even if she was from, like, if she was high bred, whatever the fuck that means, this was like a fucking come up.
Totally.
Like,
she was the first
lady.
She's in
the, she was the first leader. She's living in the White House.
Yeah.
She's the first person to have a baby in the White House, mm-hmm. like to be a young bride in the White House. So it's, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Totally. There was just such a huge difference between the two of them that it just feels like they're...
Obviously, she saw that, like, okay, this man is older than me, but I think at the time there was less of a stigma.
Yeah. Because
I think this was common.
No, people were...
I think
were,
this was really common.
There were so few then. People that thought it was gross.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, everyone was just
no
all
one thought it was gross, it seems like.
Yeah.
No one but us.
Yeah.
thought it was gross.
There were a couple papers that tried to make a thing out of it, but everyone's like, and?
Well... I think the gross thing is that he knew her when she was born.
Yeah. Nobody really talked about that part of it.
That is gross.
Yeah. But so she's, I mean, she's beautiful. She's young, popular, well-educated, cultured, fluent in German, French, and Latin. And was
Oh, fuck. Yeah. She went to school.
Yeah. She went to Wells College and graduated. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she was even an accomplished pianist. He, however, was a self-admitted lame duck president who didn't like traveling, never read, and didn't like music.
Okay, so what did they talk about?
Yeah, but they did seem to, like, she really did seem to sort of care for him and really, I don't know. Like, from all the stuff, I didn't really get into a lot of this, but it seemed like she did a lot
what,
for him.
Just what you do
yeah.
in that era.
Yeah.
That, like, she was playing the role of wife, and this yeah. is what you do as a wife.
Yeah, that's exactly
so. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. She was... surviving in her time, and that's just culture.
Yeah.
So it maybe didn't even feel weird to her because she's
even
who
though
knows?
I don't necessarily like this man.
Oh, I clearly
yeah.
he's Groper.
Yeah.
Forever to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
like
she's a woman in the 1880s.
Yeah.
So I suppose she just
exactly.
did what she had to do.
Yeah.
In the end, Grover the Garbage Juice died about 9 years after leaving office, and Frankie said that his last words were, "I have tried so hard to do the right." The end.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Yeah.
It's similar to Harding. He like stopped mid-sentence.
Yeah.
It was like, go on, read some more.
Yeah.
Is what I think his last words were. And it was like a news story about himself.
Yeah.
Wow.
Frankie was super bummed about his death for some reason. And she wore a mourning dress for 4 years. But eventually she achieved another first for a first lady. In 1913, she married Thomas Preston, an archaeologist and art history professor from her alma mater of Wells College.
That sounds more appropriate.
Yes.
Go on.
Making her the first widowed first lady to ever remarry.
The first?
I mean, a lot of them, by the time their husbands are dead, they're old. When her husband died, she was like 30. Yeah.
So she had like a second act.
Yeah, exactly. I hope that she had a much... better life. There's a lot more to the story about their kids and all. There's lots of things that I could have got into, but I really just wanted to go for the meat of
yeah,
what
of course.
What a predator he was.
Sure was.
Groper the good.
Groper.
Groper the garbage juice.
Thank you. Groper the garbage juice or Groper the good in air quotes.
Yes.
Well, our drinks are empty.
They are.
So
yes.
I guess we're.
A little
I guess
sip left. So
oh
I'm just
well.
Go.
My scandal has been done for a while, so yeah. I've been drinking. You know, American history is juicy, and we just add gin.
That's true. <yes. laughs>
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lursel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, our yes. sound engineer, our unofficial podcast producer. We cannot do this without him. I love you, Tim. Thank you so much.
Literally, this podcast would not be half of what
it wouldn't,
is today.
No, it literally wouldn't be a thing without...
It would not be a thing.
It wouldn't be a thing.
Yeah.
It would be something that we would never, ever put out for the world.
We literally would have just recorded a bunch of episodes.
And been like, oh, God, no.
They would never be edited.
This is garbage. Yeah.
We would never improve anything.
We need to make him like a letter jacket. He is the real MVP. Mm-hmm. So please rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important.
True story, guys. Please send us a written review.
Written reviews are everything. This is how we rise in the ranking as like the babiest of baby podcasts. We need this. If you like us, please share with the class. Please tell a friend. I would say please make a t-shirt.
Yes.
You don't have to, but you know, stickers if you do.
Maybe one of these days, maybe season two, we'll have like a shop where you can buy
Oh, yes.
Maybe we'll have t-shirts.
Maybe some cross-stitch. At the very least, like, a tote bag. Angry sayings. Yeah. Oh, at the very least, a tote bag, because that's, like, bare minimum. If you like
it's
us...
It's the least you could do, guys.
It is the least you can do. If you like us, follow us on social media, Beyond Reproach Pod, at Facebook, Insta, Twitter,
etc.
ECT. Goodbye, and thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Until next time.
Yeah, until next time.
Bye.
Bye.